Okay, welcome to the third in our four-part series on mental health and halacha. Tonight's discussion is mental health as pikuach nefesh. Pikuach nefesh meaning saving a life. Rabbi Abbey will speak next week. I believe he's talking about the topic of nishmartem el nefesh sechem, the imperative to protect our lives as it applies to mental health. As always, please remember that Psak goes with the Rav, and nothing in here is intended as halachic guidance. The basic point that I want to deal with is the question of viewing treatment for a mental health situation as pikuach nefesh, as saving a life, such that one would override Shabbos, for example, in order to do it, that we would give it all of the intensity that we give to other treatments which are meant to save lives. I brought you the first source here, which is not about a pikuach nefesh issue. I brought it because of he makes the connection very clearly between medication and treatment for mental health issues and other issues. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, it's part of a tshuva, part of a response in which he deals with the question of sleeping pills on Shabbos. And is one allowed to take them to enable sleeping on Shabbos? He concludes that there's room to permit. But along the way, he quotes of David Zvi Hoffman, who says the following. Heshiv lo akach, it's right after the opening words there in source number one. Heshiv lo akach, Rav Hagon, Rav David Zvi Hoffman, Vekosev Ezel Lashon, Rav David Zvi Hoffman wrote, Benogei l'trufos l'shena, regarding medication for sleep. I see no distinction between sleeping pills and other pills. He says, you may take medication that's meant to calm or to anesthetize in some way various parts of the body. And in his mind, that's how sleeping pills work. They're calming the nerves. And the point that he's making here, which I think is germane for our discussion, is that the sleeping pills are equated with medication that, I'm sorry, the medication that one takes in order to, there's lots of room, the medication that one takes in order to deal with physical ailments is equated with medication that's taken for the sake of calming anxiety and taking care of nerves. And so the question is, how far can you go with this? Will we view therapies and treatments that are meant to handle anxiety, that are meant to handle depression and so on, with categories that are analogous to the ones that we use regarding other types of medication. So whenever you're dealing with mental health issues, there's a fundamental set of challenges that have to be dealt with that are harder in certain ways than those that we deal with in other areas of medicine. As a general principle, a posik, it needs to understand the nature of the illness itself. Whatever you're talking about, whether he's talking about strep throat or heart disease or cancer or anything else, the person who's going to make the decision has to understand the nature of the illness, has to understand what the toll is for the illness if left untreated, has to understand what the treatment options are, and to the extent that medical science is able to provide that understanding, the POSIC is then able to say, okay, now let me try to apply that within the realm of halacha. But when you get to mental health professionals acknowledge that there are great deficiencies in our knowledge of mental illness in general. And there's a lot of uncertainty when it comes to applying that knowledge to a particular patient. And that's for several reasons. I was going to bring sources for all of this, but decided this part of it I can just do outside, except for one source that I brought here, which we'll come to shortly. But first of all, the history of sophisticated, evidence-based study of mental health can be measured in decades. The science of understanding and treating cognitive dysfunction, affective disorders, psychosis, it's all early stages right now, which means it's all evolving. If you imagine what it was like, right, when Rabbanim had to paskin in the early days of electricity, and some of the things that were said were just from a physics perspective bizarre, right? Electricity is lurking behind the wall, and it's waiting for someone to plug in the plug, and then it's going to, come out into the wire. No, that's not the way circuits work. It's just not. But you have to develop a certain sophistication in the science side of things that can then be explained to the rabbis who are going to decide things. And in mental health, that really is still evolving. There are common disorders for which science still has not figured out how to categorize them and how to label them. Yeah.
So on the first one, clearly there's a recognition of true thought. So what's the backstory as to why sleeping pills would be improper on Shabbat?
The only question that he's dealing with is that we have a ban on medication in general on Shabbos unless it rises to a certain level of need. So the question is, how do I view sleeping pills? Do I even view them as medicine? Is on the one hand, and on the other hand is lack of sleep. How is that? How do I analyze lack of sleep, and how do I calibrate it versus the standard categories of illness?
So in this passage, the true foot would have been forbidden, and is sleeping pills equally as forbidden? Is the question.
Right, so what he's saying is medicine in general is permitted only if it reaches a certain threshold, and the sleeping pills meet that threshold. Yes, they are considered medicine, but the need is a need that would justify it. That's one problem here, is just the lack of knowledge. Second problem is that in the standard model of illness, a patient lacks agency. In other words, the patient is ill, the patient has strep throat, whatever it is, and needs treatment in order to be made whole. And so halacha recognizes the patient as a victim, an unwilling victim of illness. But in many cases of mental illness, the patient may appear to have agency, even if they actually don't. In other words, the patient may be going for treatment, and the doctor says, psychologist says, therapist says, you know, if only they would agree to do X, if only they would, buy into the treatment, I could help them. And this can confuse the posek. You know, can you say that a patient who has a particular disorder, right? OCD is a big one. I know the Rabbi Abbey spoke about it last week. I've spoken about it in the past. Can you say the patient with OCD is exempt from washing for meals because of what washing does to them? When you look at him and say, well, look, just stop doing what you're doing. Right? Obviously, from a therapeutic perspective, that's nonsense. You can't say that to somebody and expect that it's going to be at all meaningful. But it's very hard to know when are they able and when are they unable to deal with it, and get past the problem they have. Third issue is that unlike many types of physical illness, mental illness is generally diagnosed as self-reporting. Right? It's usually based on the patient saying, this is what I'm feeling, this is what I have, as opposed to, let's say, a virus where you can do a blood test, or a bacterial infection, where again, you're able to analyze things, take blood counts, and figure out what the person has. Someone says to you, I really can't fast on Yom Kippur. I need to eat because I am feeling very depressed. And I think that having my diet, shift in this way.
Okay, back up in play. So the challenge that you have is that the person comes to you and says that they feel like they're not able to fast. Granted that people who are hungry are also self-reporting, there's still a sense of greater objectivity involved, and it's something that's easier to process. Another issue is the uncertain impact of mental illness, meaning to what extent is the patient impaired by the illness. If the patient says that they're experiencing suicidal ideation, do I take them to hospital on Shabbos? Well, there's mild ideation, there's moderate ideation, there's severe. Right? I don't know. I don't know. It could be they'd be fine. It could be they could manage throughout Shabbos. I have no idea. We have a principle, safek pikuach nefesh, right? You act. If you're not sure, you go to the hospital. But this creates great difficulties. This the uncertain impact of going without treatment or of taking one route instead of a different route makes things very difficult.
Well, just difficult to diagnose.
It's extremely difficult, yes.
That's
for all of these, yes, correct. Not to mention the challenge in terms of how to treat, meaning there are conditions, recognized and known conditions, for which there's debate as to whether it's better to treat the patient biologically or whether it's best to treat the patient through, not biologically, physiologically, put it that way, through physiological intervention, or whether it should be talk therapy, psychological intervention. Meaning that sometimes the answer is, if you don't intervene medically, all the therapy in the world isn't going to work. They're not able to listen and participate in their therapy. That's true sometimes. But sometimes it's really just a matter of being able to talk through the issues with them and get them through this process of seeing things differently, dealing with things differently, developing a different mindset. Take a look at source number two, because that's where this source becomes relevant. The article, The Roots of Mental Illness, from the American Psychological Association. Diagnosing mental illness isn't like diagnosing other chronic diseases. Heart disease is identified with the help of blood tests, electrocardiograms. Diabetes is diagnosed by measuring blood glucose levels. But classifying mental illness is a more subjective endeavor. This is back to the diagnostic problem. No blood test exists for depression. No X-ray can identify a child at risk of developing bipolar disorder, at least not yet. Thanks to new tools in genetics and neuroimaging, scientists are making progress toward deciphering details of the underlying biology of mental disorders. Yet experts disagree on how far we can push this biological model. Are mental illnesses simply physical diseases that happen to strike the brain, or do these disorders belong to a class all their own? It's a good article in its own right and worth reading the whole thing. But in terms of the diagnosis, in terms of how to understand the disease, and then in terms of how to make recommendations, so much of this is new territory, and so much of it is simply uncertain right now, or lacks the ability for us to get quality testimony, so to speak, from the patient or from the physician, that the rabbi looks at this and says, I don't know what to do. One of the worst days of the year for a rabbi is Erev Yom Kippur. And Erev Yom Kippur, you know exactly what's going to happen. People who have been taking medications for weeks suddenly wake up and realize, I have a medication I take every day, and it needs to be taken at a certain time of day, and it needs to be taken with food. Am I able to take it on Yom Kippur? And very often, unfortunately, what you're dealing with are these types of illnesses where it's so vague, it's so unclear what you're going to be doing by having the patient fast, and the doctors themselves aren't necessarily sure what the result's going to be. Some things you know. This you can skip a day, this you can't skip a day. There are areas where there is knowledge. But on the whole, it's very difficult. So all of this has to be taken into consideration when we weigh the question of how we look at mental illness, and are we willing to say, in certain cases, that treatment, in fact, is pikuach nefesh. It is considered life-saving, and therefore will override any number of potential prohibitions. So what I want to show you is three different levels of viewing mental illness as potentially a pikuach nefesh situation, a life-threatening or life-saving situation. Each of these levels has been taken in relation to particular areas, or certainly the first two. The third one is really dicey. But the first two are documented approaches which have been used in various situations. So the first level is the most straightforward, as I titled it, Concern for Self-Harm. In other words, the fear that we have is that in the event that we don't treat the patient, in the event that we don't provide this, the patient might harm his or herself. And this is an old idea. This goes back to the period of the Rishonim, probably earlier, but the Rishonim documented. If you take a look at Rashi in source number 2, on the Gemara in Tanis, the Gemara says, Yachid shen nirdaf mipnei nachim ovnei listin mipnei rach ra'a al kulan yachid rasha l'sagev es atzma b'tanis. If somebody is being chased by non-Jews, he's being chased by bandits, he's being chased by ruach ra'a. Ruach ra'a, the Rambam classified as melancholy, also known as depression. But in all of these cases, one would be allowed to fast on Shabbos on behalf of this person. Even though normally we don't allow fasting on Shabbos, you would be allowed to fast on Shabbos as part of an effort to accumulate merit on behalf of the person who's suffering from this condition. That's the Gemara. So look at Rashi on that Gemara in source number 3, Mipnei Ruach Ra, he says, Shenichnas bo Ruach Sheda, some kind of spirit possession, whatever it is, has entered him. Virats v'holeich, and he runs and he walks or he runs along. V'shema yitba benahar o yipol v'yamus, and we're concerned he might drown. We're concerned he might fall from a height and die under the influence of whatever it is that he is gripped by. Leaving aside the question of what in the world shadim slash demons are, and going with the Rambam's definition of ruach ra, which is what Rashi is commenting on there, the concern is that he in fact might be harmed at his own hand. Take a look at source number 4, a little bit later in history. Rav Meir HaKohen of Rothenburg, student of the Maharam Rothenburg, and he's quoting the Maharam Rothenburg. He says, Sha'alu l'Rebbe al nichfe echad. They asked my master, the Maharam, regarding someone who was nichfe. Nichfe usually is taken to mean somebody with seizures, some kind of a seizure disorder, but it doesn't have to be, as we'll see here. Vayarotza akum echad l'rap oso. There was a non-Jewish doctor who wanted to treat him. Ulhachilo ma'achal echad l'refua. He wanted to give him this supposedly therapeutic food. Shenir nadvarm sheyesh bo sheretz ha'of l'fi ha'inyan. And based on the way they usually treat, it was expected that this food that he wanted him to eat has some kind of non-kosher flying creature in it. What it is, we don't know. Some kind of sheretz ha'of. Veheshiv, and he answered, ki nichfa choli gadol, that this illness of nichfa, which may be a seizure disorder, may not be, may be somebody who engages in activity that seems to be involuntary physical activity. So he said, this is a great illness. Ukamaka shel chalal dami. It's like an internal wound. And those are important words. In the area of the laws of Shabbos, we talk about maka shel chalal, internal wounds. That means illnesses which are not visible or wounds that are not visible to the eye, and therefore you don't really know what's wrong. And therefore, you have to err on the side of caution. That's what we mean when we talk about a makah shel chalal. So he says that's what this disorder is like. Upa'amim shemistakein, and sometimes he will be in danger. No felba, or he could fall into a fire, or b'mayim, or into water. Umuter harafua yidua. If this cure is known to be the way you treat this disorder, he'd be allowed to eat it, even though the food is not kosher. That's the statement that he makes because of harm he might do to himself. That's the salient point here. What we're concerned about is self-harm. And this is something that is brought by modern poskim. There's a tshuva of the Pri Haaretz who uses this to talk about treating somebody with mental illness with food that is treif. The Minchas Yitzchak, Rav Yitzchak Weiss, who we'll talk about more in the second category of Pikuach Nefesh, but he talks about this also regarding a woman with postpartum depression and the question of whether she's allowed to engage in contraception in order to avoid her to avoid self-harm. Rav Moshe Feinstein used this a lot. He actually had a tshuva. Is this the one that I translated? Yes, it is. In source number 5, this is a tshuva he wrote to Rav Yaakov Emanuel Shochet in 1965 regarding a young man who was going to be committed to an asylum where he would not be able to observe halacha. So look at what Rav Moshe writes here. Ula yishlidon mitzad machalaso. He says there's room to discuss this in terms of the illness this fellow has. Im yomru arof im shiyesh baze inyan pikuach nefesh. If the doctors say that this is a life-saving situation, kigon, for example, da alul mizel harogis atzmo beim yiyelo ezetzar, that we're concerned he might take his own life if he is in pain. O diyarval dvarm sha'asurim gam b'dinei hamedino, or maybe he will break laws of the government. V'lo yishma laha police, v'yariv imam achiyavo mizeshi arguhu, and maybe he's going to get himself into a fight with the police, and he's not going to listen to them when they tell him to stop, and they might kill him. O sheyomru de'etz ha'machla, hisakana shebalo mikilkul shebemocho, v'yashal raposa elba makamahu, or maybe the illness itself actually represents a danger to him, and we're going to talk about that when we get to level 2. But the central part within Rav Moshe's tshuva here, the piece that I've excerpted, is the fear that the person who is suffering from the illness is not going to die of the illness, but will die of the actions that he might take on as a result of it. And this could be considered a pikuach nefesh situation, Ramosha has another tshuva, also a postpartum depression tshuva, in source number 6. This is a woman who already has small children, and the fear is that if she becomes pregnant, and carries a child, that the resulting disorder for her could be so bad that she might harm her children. So he writes, Hine vadai tzadak kvod taras harav. He says, the person who wrote to me, his honor is certainly correct. Sheshtus hu inyan sakana, that being in the state of shota, meaning irrationality, is a dangerous thing. Lo rak la'atzma, not only for her personally, ela gam la'yaladim haktanim, but also her small children. Sha'af mi sheshtuso eino lasos ra, even if you have somebody whose disorder is such that it doesn't normally lead them to do bad things, to harm people, efshar lihis hapeich, that could change. Shetirtze lasos ra la'atzmo la'yaladim chas v'shalom, that may be. It's true, until now she hasn't been dangerous. But you don't know necessarily that won't change. V'yesher l'hamid shomrim alzeh, it's not like you can appoint guards. V'lachen yesh l'hatur l'shamish b'moch, and so he's willing to permit contraception in that case. There's another case, which I didn't bring here, where he has a tshuv that he wrote in 1951 to Rav David Ox, in which he talks about a couple who should not marry, but they're so enthralled with each other that there could be danger in not allowing them to marry. There's a fear that depression could set in if they wouldn't be allowed to marry. It was a birth control situation because the fear was she's not supposed to become pregnant, therefore we shouldn't let them get married. But if we don't, it could be dangerous. Rav Moshe has quite a few tshuvos on this issue. Not everybody is in agreement on this, meaning there are those who say, yeah, this is unlikely. Rav Unterman, Rav Isser Yehuda Unterman, said he wasn't so quick to support this, based on a Gemara Nedarim. The Gemara Nedarim is a classic medical halacha Gemara. It's one of these really good sources where you look at it and say, I don't know what I just read, but it really matters. Take a look at source number 7. Talking about the distribution of resources. Ma'ayan shel bnei ha'ir. There's a river that is used by the population of a certain city. But like all rivers, it runs downstream, and there's a city upstream, and there's a city downstream. The city upstream uses the water that's less for the people who are downstream for it. So, Mayan shel bnei ha'ir, chayein v'chayei acherim, chayein kodmin l'chayei acherim. If you have these two cities, and the people in the upper city need this water in order to live, they need drinking water, and the people in the city down below need drinking water. The people in the upper city are entitled to say, our lives come first. We don't have to give up our lives and be unable to drink water so that the people downstream are able to survive. Behem tam, their animals, u behem as acherim, versus the animals of the people in the lower city. Behem tam kodem as the behem as acherim. So again, they're allowed to say, our animals come first. We don't have to sacrifice the water in order that their animals should get. Kvisasan u kvisas acherim, we need to do laundry. They need to do laundry. Kvisasan kodem le kvisas acherim, our laundry comes first. Then you get to the difficult case. What if it's a matter of laundry for the people in the upper city? They just need water for laundry. They have enough to drink. They're okay. Their animals have enough to drink too. They just need water for laundry. The people in the town downstream need the water as drinking water. So logically, you would say, who comes first?
Downstream,
drinking water, right? Why would I have thought otherwise? So the Tanakhama, the first view says, you're right. First, you give the drinking water to the people down below. Rabbi Yossi Omer kvisasan kodemes l'chayacherim. Rabbi Yossi says, no, laundry comes first. So this leads everybody who reads this Gemara to say something else must be going on, but I don't know what it is. So one view, basically, you have two main views. One view is to say that what we're talking about here for laundry must be so extreme that it's actually going to harm the health of the people in the upper city if they don't do laundry. The other approach is to say, we must, even though we said chayei acherim, we can't really mean that the people downstream have no water to drink. It must just mean that they'd have to ration their water or something. It can't mean that you're going to let people die so that you can have clean clothing. That's just bizarre. Take a look at what Rav Unterman does in source number 8. It's part of a much longer piece. He quotes the Hamek Sheila of the Netziv. So the Hamek She'ela Mefaresh ki plugtasam tzluya beplugtas ben Petura of Rabbi Akiva. The whole debate going on in source number 7 is the debate between Ben Petura and Rabbi Akiva about whose life comes first. If you have resources and you can use them and live, but if you share them with somebody else, then you're not going to make it, and he's not going to make it. Are you entitled to say, my life comes first? That's the debate that this, that's what this is all about in number 7. And he says, it should say viniflaim. That's a typo. Sorry. Viniflaim be'enai hadvarim ma'od. Rav Unterman says, the idea that this is really a debate about the lives of the people above and the lives of the people below, he says, that's incredible to me. And not in a good way. He says that's just, that can't be. You can't tell me that we're talking about where the people downstream are going to die of thirst. How in the world could Rabbi Yossi say that your laundry comes before the survival of somebody else? He says, even though it's true, we have a principle that says that if your clothing is dirty, if you wear the same stuff day after day after day and it's dirty, it can bring to shiamum, which is some form of depression. He says, this does not at all qualify as an immediate threat the way not drinking would qualify. It's not even a potential danger. It's something which could eventually lead to sakana. Rav Unterman is less convinced that this is actually, that depression is actually that level of threat. He also brings a proof from the Chasam Sofer in source number 9. This is a classic tshuva, the Chasam Sofer's tshuva. It's worth seeing the whole thing, but I, of course, did not bring the whole thing. But the Chasam Sofer's tshuva is used by everybody in terms of a very major question which he deals with, which unfortunately is common. And that was this question. The young man, at that point still a child, is diagnosed with also some kind of a mental health problem, and it's not clear from the tshuva exactly what it is that he's dealing with. I mean, keep in mind, this is the beginning of the 19th century. But they want to commit him to some form of institution or asylum where he will not get kosher food. And the question is, are you allowed to put him in there? So the Chasam Sofer, in his concluding section, writes the following in source number 9. Mikomakom bahasal kinon de la rov haposkim mashma pshitus de bameshim amido etzel nachrim eno kemachilo biyadayim. He says, we conclude that according to the majority of authorities, putting him in such an institution where he's taken care of by non-Jews is not the same thing as handing him non-kosher food to eat. And therefore there's room for leniency. When you're dealing with a child who's underage, you're not allowed to give a child isurim to perform. You can't give a child non-kosher food. But on the other hand, you don't have to object if he's still under the age of education, which this child is. Not just under the age of bar mitzvah, but under the age of education. Imkain hachi shari, so this would be permitted, but then the Chasam Sofer writes, uvitznai shekshiagia leben yud gimel shanim v'yom echad yotzi'uhu misham al kolpanim. He says, once he reaches the age of bar mitzvah, you got to take him out. He's not allowed, he's not willing to leave the child in this institution. So Rabbi Unterman quotes that and says, if this were a pikuach nefesh situation, then you would leave him in there. Life saving. You would feed him yourself with treif. What do you mean? So he says, clearly we don't view it as pikuach nefesh. Now, this has to be case dependent. There's no way that this is a valid blanket ruling for all cases of mental illness. But it tells you that there is somebody on the other side. Here I brought you in number 10, a source that I also brought at greater length in the first week of the series when we talked about Kavod HaBrios issues. Here I'm just bringing it to note, I think almost everyone here was here the first week, not everybody. This is a remarkable meta-study. It's a study of studies that have been done regarding teens who self-injure. And they're trying to figure out why it is that certain teens will not only self-injure, but will also submit themselves to painful situations longer than others. And what they discover in their studies is that those who have a bad self-image, those who describe themselves as bad, defective, deserving of punishment, are far more likely to engage in self-harm. essentially what's going on is they find meaning in the experience of pain. This is, for them, a fulfillment of what they believe they should endure, which is very important in terms of what we discussed in the first week, in terms of the issue of human dignity. That was our discussion then in Kavod HaBrios and the importance of self-image. But it's also important here, because again, you have concerns for people who are going to harm themselves. This is a factor as well. Mental health disorder can indeed lead to self-injury. Now, you might ask a legitimate question here. I know I asked this question when I first learned this topic, which is, maybe the answer is not violate Shabbos. Maybe the answer is lock the person up. Right? Maybe the answer is, if your concern is that someone with this kind of a condition is going to harm themselves or harm other people, so maybe the answer is confine them rather than break Shabbos, rather than give them treif. Maybe is, why isn't that the answer that we're giving? So first of all, it's worth noting that you can't really, meaning it's really hard to actually confine a person in such a way that they're not going to be a threat to themselves.
There's a less intrusive option just to be in their presence.
Meaning?
You don't have to lock them up and you don't have to give them medication. You just be present.
Right, but being present requires that somebody actually be there.
Yeah,
so yes.
The Kehillah says this person is at risk.
Right.
We're just going to make sure he's near one of us.
Right.
Until the end of Shabbat.
Right.
That's not incarcerating them, and that's not giving them food.
Right. If you're dealing with the case just for that Shabbos, then I think you have something. Assuming that they can deal with that as well, because the person who's in the situation, they're having a terrible anxiety attack or they're dealing with terrible depression. Even having somebody else present may be insufficient.
It's a self harm question.
Right.
It's only self harm. So they're going to die inside of themselves.
So we still have to get to the other two levels that we have to look at within this. Right now, we're only looking at it in terms of level one and what they might do. This is true, but I think number one, we're talking about something that's more than just this Shabbos. In other words, your question will stand if it's just right now. Do I take them to the hospital? But in terms of an ongoing treatment, like the question of committing them to an institution, I think it's very important to recognize that from a halachic perspective, we don't require that sort of measure. That's not where we go. So if you take a look, I brought you a couple of sources that support this. Number 11 is Rabbi Chiya Michal Epstein, the Aruch HaShulchan, dealing with the question of why it is that you're allowed to walk on snow on Shabbos. You know that you're going to be crushing the snow. So he says, V'dores ha'adam shelag baragla v'eino choshesh. You're allowed to crush snow with your feet and not, you don't have to be concerned. V'afa pi shelo yimale, d'derech dwi chaso, nimas ma'at shelag. You know that, it's psik reshe, it's a guaranteed result, that some of the snow is going to be crushed and will melt as you walk on it. Mikomakom still, kevin d'zeu derech hilucho, since this is the way people walk, it's the manner of walking is what you're doing. Lo shayach le'aser bazeh. First of all, it's reduced to a derabanan. But he says, we're not going to prohibit. The im kain, if you would, in nias gurim bebatenu kol yamei achoref. You'd be locked in your house all winter, right? In Novarduk. You'd be locked in all winter long. Velo gazu bazeh. We don't have such decrees for a derabanan. What?
Just for Shabbos.
Right, that's true. Just for Shabbos, that's all. You're right. Rav Ovadia has a tshuva like this, quoting Rav Unterman, actually, regarding somebody who is blind. The discussion that he's having is treating blindness as pikuach nefesh, because a person who's blind could fall, a person who's blind could be attacked. So look at what he says. He quotes Rav Unterman in the Shevet Meyehuda. Sha'achar shechilek bein suma lenichfa. After making a distinction between somebody who is blind and somebody who has a seizure disorder, kaamur, kasa b'zeh alashon. Rav Unterman wrote the following: Shuv his bonanti ki ein lechalek bein zeh lazeh. I don't think there's any distinction. He decides between the person who is blind and the person who has epilepsy or seizures of some kind. V'yesh sakana mamashit gam lesuma. There's also real danger for the blind person. V'lachen mikri pikuach nefesh l'rapa usa me'ivaron. And therefore, it's pikuach nefesh to heal him from his blindness. Mishum shelo yitachein shasuma yeshev tamid b'bayit. He says it's impossible that he should just sit at home all the time, or again, go out with somebody who's going to look after him. Ukshov verberachov or vos lo sakanos shanos. When he goes in the street, there are all sorts of dangers. V'gam tzirich lalos v'levedes b'madrigos. He has to go up and down steps. Vein hasakana nimnas. He says the danger here is not distant. Like it's a real substantive risk, and we're not expecting the answer is not keep him at home. The answer is that we have to treat it. I mean, you can see it also in one of the earlier tshuvas that I mentioned, the one about contraception, right? No one there said let them just abstain. That wasn't one of the solutions. So what we understand here is that that there is a recognition that mental illness may create potential harm for the person who is ill or the people around them, and that as a result, we would consider a pikuach nefesh in terms of the need for treatment. That's level one.
How do you treat blind?
Well, he was dealing with cornea transplants, and the question of whether you call that life-saving. Level two is mental illness itself leading to death. There is a lot of evidence for this, in particular, if you're dealing with people who are already physically ill in some other way, in terms of the impacts of stress. I quoted you an article that I find funny in source number 13. I actually communicated with the author because I couldn't believe what he wrote. This I gave a shiur last year, the year before, on the question of informing somebody of their terminal diagnosis. So he wrote an article, this fellow wrote an article, in which he argued that the classic view in the Gemara, which is that if you give somebody terrible news like that, you could actually diminish their prospects for survival. You're going to reduce their remaining life. He said, that's nonsense. That's because they lived in a world in which they lumped together the spirit and the body, and therefore they thought if you harm the person's spirit, you're also harming the body. Take a look at this quote, number 13. Regarding the interplay between psychology and biology, the gap between the outlook of Chazal and the perspective of contemporary medicine is multidimensional. First, whereas Chazal breathed and functioned in an essentially Aristotelian world that took the seamless unity of both existence and knowledge for granted, modern science operates within a fractious intellectual outlook that utterly forbids the mixing of spirit and material substance. Accordingly, while Chazal might have embraced spiritual or psychological explanations for disease, contemporary medicine insists upon organic theories. Stress as the basis for stomach ulcers has been replaced by bacterial infection. Freudian descriptions of neurosis have given way to hormonal imbalances in the brain. The same holds true for the hypothesis that any degree of mental distress can be lethal for a fragile patient. What for Chazal might have seemed intuitive to the point of obvious is at best eyed with wariness by modern medicine and at worst with derision. I'm sorry. I showed this article to quite a few doctors, and I have yet to see a doctor who did not respond to this article with derision. This is complete and utter rot. I wrote to the writer. I thought he was really overstating his case, but he more or less stood his ground, more or less. But I gave you just basics in number 14 of some of the negative medical impact of stress and the fight or flight response. Raises the heart rate and the blood pressure because the norepinephrine neurotransmitter is released in the body for fight and flight response. Fight or flight response. The body metabolizes fat and protein. You have an elevated blood sugar. That's from the cortisol that is secreted. It suppresses the immune response as the body channels metabolic resources elsewhere. You get flu-like symptoms, allergic reactions, and inflammations. There's a narrowing of focus. The brain focuses on this particular stress and stops processing other sensory information. There are all sorts of potential negative results. Now, I don't want to say that stress is fatal. I say that for a few reasons. Number one, I don't want to overstate the case in terms of what the evidence says. But number two, I like the work of a fellow whose name, his last name I never really learned how to pronounce. His first name is Hans. His last name is spelled S-E-L-Y-E. I think it's Selye, but I don't actually know. But he's done a lot of work on what he calls eustress. EU stress. And it's the idea of good stress. And basically his philosophy is, and it's borne out by studies, that people who approach stressful situations from a perspective of this is going to be good for me, I can deal with this, do a lot better and can actually have positive results from it. That's really not the topic of this shiur. We're not talking right now about dealing with stress. But there is the possibility that some of the effects of stress, especially if it's short-term stress, can be mitigated. Nonetheless, it's very clear in the literature that anxiety, stress, and stress is really a catch-all word for different conditions which will tax the body's systems and especially trigger the fight or flight response. These can have really bad impacts on people whose health is already compromised in particular. So I brought you just a few pieces here. Source number 16 is
How about depression?
Depression for sure as well. Yeah. Absolutely. Source number 16 is a great article. I highly recommend it. Should Sabbath prohibitions be overridden to provide emotional support to a sick relative? Quotes all sorts of tshuvos about this issue of whether one could go to the hospital to be with somebody who is dangerously ill on Shabbos, and deals with a lot of evidence medically in this regard. So an example of this, take a look at source number 17. Anxiety during the in-hospital phase of AMI. AMI is acute myocardial infarction. So anxiety during this state of a cardiac incident is associated with increased risk for in-hospital arrhythmic and ischemic complications, independent of traditional sociodemographic and clinical risk factors. This relationship is moderated by level of perceived control, such that the combination of high anxiety and low perceived control is associated with the highest risk of complications. When patients have high anxiety after a heart incident and a low sense of control, especially if they don't have visitors, is the point within this article, they feel like there's nobody who's going to be arguing for them, you actually find physiological complications. I didn't bring it on this. There's another article that I saw that talked about extreme anger and general stress as triggers for acute cardiac events in people who are already ill, who already have coronary artery disease. The article that I brought you here in 18, the excerpt that I brought you here, depression and anxiety among patients with acute myocardial ischemia are highly prevalent and independently associated with adverse cardiovascular outcomes, including mortality. You follow that? Depression and anxiety among these heart patients, number one, it's highly prevalent, but number two, it's independently associated with bad outcomes, including mortality. Mortality is death. Thank you. One more on delirium in number 19. Delirium is a complex neuropsychiatric syndrome commonly encountered across all healthcare settings and associated with adverse outcomes, including more prolonged hospitalization, institutionalization, and increased mortality independent of age, prior cognitive functioning, and comorbidities. In a recent study, mortality was shown to increase by 11% for every additional 48 hours of active delirium, highlighting the need for timely detection and treatment. And the articles go on and on and on, and from journals across the spectrum, from JAMA and the British Medical Journal to journals that no one's ever heard of. It seems very clear that the article in Tradition notwithstanding, there is a detected and tested connection between the stress, the anxiety, the depression, and the impact on a person's health, and again, in particular, for somebody who is already vulnerable, someone who's already compromised.
Shabbat?
Sorry?
Are we still talking about medications on Shabbat?
That could be one case. It's not the only one.
No, I mean the Bikuach Nefesh issue.
Yeah.
Is it limited to the Chagim and Shabbat alone?
No. No, it'll come up in other cases. So, for example, the case of putting somebody into an institution where they're not going to be able to have kosher food. Mm-hmm. That will be another example of it. Another example of it, although this is dicier, and I want to be very careful about this. I want to give a shiur on this at some point. There's a lot of resistance throughout the 20th century to use of psychologists at all because of the feeling that the methods of psychology call for people to be independent individuals and to do whatever makes them feel good. And that was the perceived that was the perception of how psychological treatment works. And there's a fear that psychologists will tell the patients, if you just drop all of this Judaism, your life would be a lot simpler and you'd be a lot happier. So as a result, you find some very strong statements among some very serious halachic authorities against going to such doctors. Well, here's the question now. What if it's a choice between that and dying? Right? What if we believe that this is a pikuach nefesh situation? Is it worth taking the risk that the treatment might actually risk some level of the person's halachic observance? These are very serious issues. It's very clear to me that the Gemara is concerned for this level two, this idea that not only could mental illness lead a person to harm others or themselves actively, but it could be damaging for that person's health in and of itself. Source number 20 is a Gemara that talks about somebody who sees that a child is locked in a room. Rush and in a delis bifnei tinok. If somebody sees a child is locked in a room, shovra umotzio. You break the door down and take the kid out. This is Shabbos that we're talking about. Vahazariz harezim mishubach. One who is energetic about it is to be praised. Vein tzarech litol rishus mibeis din. You don't need to get any permission from a beis din. You know, well, it's not my house. You know, type of a thing. It doesn't make a difference. Because not that the child is locked in there and is going to harm themselves with something on the other side. It's that the anxiety itself is potentially harmful to this child. Zigmar in Shabbos, source number 21, that says you're not supposed to sleep in a room alone, in a house alone. And the Meiri comments on that, and he says, V'chein b'kolshu mevi atzmo lidei nisayon shel pachad. Anytime you engage in an activity that could bring you to great fear, to panic, it's usur. And then he says it's all based on your nature. Maybe you don't mind sleeping in a house alone. Maybe you like horror movies. I don't know. I'm going to actually just run with this for a little bit in the interest of time. I'm going to skip the Yerushalmi in 22, although it's interesting, but I want to jump to the source 23 and the ones that follow, which speak about somebody who is already physically ill. The classic is source number 23. The Gemara in Shabbos talks about a woman who is giving birth. And it says, if she needs a candle, she needs a lamp, so let somebody light a lamp for her. So the Gemara says, Pshita, well, that's obvious. She's giving birth. Obviously, she's in danger. Lo, tzricha besuma. No, what we're saying is, even if she's blind, if she calls for a lamp, we still light it. Mau desema kevin to lochazia asur. I might have said, she can't tell the difference anyway. Just tell her you lit the lamp. What's the difference? Kamash malan, esuve mias vadaita. Savra iika midi chazi chavirta va'avdoli. The answer is that it's teaching us that we want to settle her mind by making sure that she has this lamp, because then she will feel like if there's any need, don't worry about it. My friend who can see will take care of it, because now there's a lamp that's lit for her. But the message here is it's about setting her mind at ease when she is in a delicate physical state. Gemara in Moikatan in source number 24. You have somebody who is already ill. A relative of that person dies. He says, we don't inform him of the death of the relative, lest he become aggravated and agitated. And again, you risk his life. Source number 25. You have somebody who is a shchiv mera. The person is already dying. So we said, you do a kinyan with him. For, you know, he says, I want to give some of my property away. You're not allowed to do kinyanim ordinarily. It's rabbinically prohibited, lest you write things down. You're allowed to engage in the transaction, shema titrov daito alav, because you don't want a situation in which he gets upset. The source after source after source supports this idea that we are concerned not only that they might actively harm, but that the illness that they are suffering itself, the stress of it, might harm them. And this comes up in modern psak. Rav Moshe Feinstein, once again, who we saw so much of in level one, also buys into level two. He has quite a few responses that speak about this. I brought you one example in source number 27. He's talking about a case in which you're doing triage. There are multiple people who need to be treated. You brought somebody into the room and you gave them the bed. And you can see this person, there's nothing I can do. They're going to be gone in a couple of hours. On the other end, there's someone waiting for a bed, waiting to be treated. And there actually is something you could do for them. That person could be treated and could get better. So what do you do? this person is already here. So the general rule is you can't give up the patient in front of you in order to take somebody else. What about where you haven't yet taken either of them? Both of them are coming in at the same time. So what are your options? So Rav Moshe writes here in source number 27, you can opt for the other, but davka ba'ofen shelo yeda hachola mesukan shelafi umdunus harof mi'efsher l'raposo, only where the patient who is in danger will not realize that you've given up hope of helping him, that you're actually going for the other and you're not helping him. He has, as long as he won't realize that you can't heal him. If he knows that you can't heal him, he is going to be frightened. We're worried about potentially bringing his death closer. So Rav Moshe says you can't do that. Rav Moshe has many tshuvos on this. One of the most famous is only famous for the result. People don't know how Rav Moshe got there. But you've all heard the idea that in the event that someone is taking, let's say, antibiotics, and it requires that you take it over a period of days, and one of those days is Shabbos, since you started the medication days ago, you're allowed to continue it. So there are different halachic arguments to justify that ruling. Rav Moshe's justification is perplexing. Rav Moshe's justification, I didn't bring it here, is that in the event that somebody would halt his course of medication, that would give him anxiety and it could lead to a nervous breakdown. The anxiety of, maybe now the medication I took isn't going to work. That anxiety alone is sufficient for Moshe to justify this. But it's all of a piece. It's his belief that that stress can be harmful to the body. He talks about somebody who wants people to daven for him on Shabbos. So he says, you're allowed to daven for him on Shabbos, again, lest he be agitated. The Tzitz Eliezer, in source number 28, discusses this as well. He's dealing with a Radbaz. The problem that he's addressing is this. The Radbaz wrote that you're allowed to violate the orisas on Shabbos for a patient. And there were other cases where it seems like we only permit derabanans. And so the question is why in some cases will we permit derabanans and in other cases only derabanans? And take a look at what he writes. V'tzarech lomar. D'sha'ani ha'davar b'hecha d'chashashas tiruf daito hum epnei shalom emalim ritzono b'davar shechoshev she'em yimlo ritzono v'yitnu lo zeh yavi lo ha'davar es rifu aso b'kfisha meduba b'radbaz. He says the case in the Radbaz is somebody who wants certain things. He has requested certain things. And our fear is, he thinks that his cure is dependent on it. And he feels like, if you don't do this, then I won't be cured. And we're worried that he's going to become upset. Ki b'sham, in that case, chashashas hatiruf yecholo lahavi eno lidei sakana mamashit. He says, the fear there is so strong for him that it could actually endanger him. As opposed to where the fear is that, you know, he's upset because of something that is external. It's not about his cure. Let's say you have a man who believes that he is dying and he asks that they divorce his wife for him, that they write a get. But it's Shabbos and I don't want to write the get on Shabbos. But he's scared that if she doesn't get the get, then she's going to be stuck for Yibum with his no good brother. So there, it isn't the same threat to his life. He won't have the same degree of agitation, is what the Tzitz Eliezer says. I'm recognizing that I'm short on time, so I'm gonna race a little bit now, even further. I'm gonna stick around at the end for questions. But the Tzitz Eliezer says there are cases where failure to fulfill his wish will actually endanger his health. The Menchas Yitzchak discusses this. I brought you a piece in 29. He talks about somebody who is ill and needs to be hospitalized, and he wants to bring in his tefillin. But he has an illness for which he's quarantined, and they won't let him leave the hospital with anything. They're going to insist on burning it. So are you allowed to bring in the tefillin? And the Menchas Yitzchak says yes. And one of the pieces of this is because of the agitation this person will experience if he doesn't have the tefillin and the deleterious effect it can have on his health. Shmir Shabbos Kehilchasa talks about this as well, regarding lighting a flame for somebody who is already seriously ill, not the birth case, the different case. Most of the sources, almost all the sources, talk about somebody who is already ill. But in number 30, I brought you a piece from Rav Yashiv, as quoted by his son-in-law, Rav Zilberstein, regarding a therapist for a married couple. Actually, he's not quite a married couple. The story in this case is that he is called in to treat a child, if I remember correctly. And it's a therapy issue for the child. But in the course of treating the child, it becomes clear to him that the parents have issues between them. And his question that he asked to Rav Zilberstein is, am I obligated, lo samot al dam rayecha, am I obligated to say something to the parents, you know, about their own issues and try to help them with their issues? So along the way, Rav Yashiv says what I brought you here in number 30. And again, in the interest of time, I'm just mentioning this. I'm not going to go into it inside, but you can see it. And the Hebrew is not a terribly hard Hebrew. But he argues that fights between the husband and wife can lead to bitterness between them and can lead to depression, which he says is itself pikuach nefesh. He's not talking about people who are already ill. He argues that there is a danger to their health based on the depression alone, not level one. I'm afraid they're going to hurt somebody. But even in of itself, that this could be harmful to their health. He's very clear about it. He quotes you when Rachel says to Yaakov, Havali banim vim ayin mesa anochi, that give me children, and if not, I will die. He takes that very seriously, that this is actually harmful to their health. So that's a second level. Then there's level three. Level three is out on a limb. Level three is the idea that being in a state of mental illness could be equated with death itself. Just being in that state could actually be equated with death itself. That's a hard thing to say. It's a hard thing to say in terms of the pain that is involved. Mm-hmm. It is true. I brought you source number 31 from the Nishma Shabbos, who quotes Rav Zilberstein, to say that unbearable pain may be called a pikuach nefesh situation, as one could lose one's mind as a result of the pain. But he's dealing with physical pain there. He's dealing with, I believe, trigeminal neuralgia, I believe is the case that he's dealing with. But there is something interesting that's worth seeing, and that's source number 32. Rav Nosson Tzvi Friedman, also known as the Netzer Mata'ai, is talking about violating mitzvos in order to take care of somebody who's dealing with a mental illness. And he says, the Gemara in Yuma that talks about healing people at the expense of Shabbos, or at the expense of Yom Kippur, brings all sorts of reasons why we break Shabbos in order to do so. And the ultimate answer that the Gemara brings is, v'chai bohem, live by the mitzvahs, v'lo shiyamus bohem, don't die by them. So in source number 32, he says, v'im alimud hu v'chai bohem v'lo shiyamus bohem, if that's the source, nichlal bazeh gam refuas chole ruach. I think that should include people who have these mental illnesses as well. Shari mikra mali diber akasuv, because the Torah says, le'ahavas Hashem alokecha, l'shmo b'kolo l'dav kavo, you are commanded to listen to God and stick to Him, ki hu chayecha ba'orech yamecha, because that is your life. Doing mitzvos is your chayim, is your life. Well, the person who is mentally ill, he says, is a shote, and exempt from mitzvos. So therefore he's being kept from his life. Now, not all cases of mental illness are necessarily shota cases. However, many cases of mental illness will keep a person from fulfilling particular mitzvos. Whether it's somebody who has depression and can't leave the house to go to minyan or engage can't even get out of bed necessarily, and can't engage in various mitzvos. As one example, a person who has an anxiety disorder and therefore cannot participate in various ways. And then he goes into the other big drasha there in the Gemara. Break one Shabbos so that he can participate in many Shabbatot, and he applies that here as well. The Netzer Mata'ai makes the argument that if you're going to believe that we break Shabbos to save somebody's life because of a Chai Bohem, then maybe we should also be able to do that in order to enable them to fulfill mitzvos as we cure them from their state of mental illness. This is an extreme. I haven't seen others who adopt this view, but I think it's a very interesting view and worth noting. So what we've seen are three levels. After we talked about the difficulty and the challenges of, in general, poskening on mental illness issues, I think we see three levels. Number one, it's considered pikuach nefesh if they might harm themselves or others. Number two is that the illness itself, particularly if they're already in a case of physical illness, could be deleterious to their health, particularly if they have heart issues. And number three, the argument of equating a state of mental illness where one cannot keep to halacha with death. That's the third and most difficult level. I had a few other questions that I thought there might be time to address, but I see that it is 9:30. So I'll just mention one in particular, and those who have to go can go. But what about a patient who is not manifesting mental illness yet, but might develop it if left untreated now? Right now, they'll manage. They're going to survive Shabbos. However, they go into a tailspin, and who knows where it ends. So I brought you from Rav Yashiv here, source number 33. Ukein ze shamanu shayamaisa bechole shachefes shorofei hiter lo latzum biyom kippurim. There was a person who was ill with the case of shachefes. Shachefes is some kind of a physical disorder. It's not a mental disorder. But the doctor said that he's allowed to fast. Don't worry about it. Me'achav ha'isalo hatava. He got better. He hadn't gotten better. He was improved. V'lohayaz matzav shasakana. He's not dangerously ill. Amar Hagan Rabbi Yitzchak Zev Soloveitchik, Rav Mibrisk, the Brisker Rav says to the doctor, Pikuach nefesh ein perusho shekaes yistakein v'yamus. Saving a life doesn't mean, if I don't do this right now, he's going to die right now. That's not pikuach nefesh. Ela av im hatzom yashpia alav ka'avor shanim. Even if the fast that he does today could affect him years down the road. Kesher yitakev shubamachala, when it breaks out again. And as a result of fasting today, he dies younger than he should have. That's also pikuach nefesh. That's the quote from the Brisker Rav. So, heishiv lo harofei, the doctor says to him, agmas hanefesh itigareim lechole me'etzem idiaso shu mugdar kemesukan alula sakein oso. The doctor says back to the Brisker Rav, if you tell him that his health is in danger from fasting on Yom Kippur, the depression you're going to cause him from knowing his health is that precarious is itself dangerous to him. So Brisker Rav says, oh, wait a minute, then I better rethink this. In that case, it's worth rethinking this. But I bring this to show you the idea that even if it's not right now that the person is dangerously ill, but it could lead there, then we may say he's in a pikuach nefesh situation right now. And indeed, Rav Yehuda Leib Graubart, who was one of the Rabbanim in Toronto in the early 20th century, I believe he was the first one on the Eruv. Sorry? Viewmath. Okay. I can still mention him here. So look at what he said in source number 34. He's trying to argue about comparing two different cases, and he says, Sha'ani Hasim, the case where it's permitted to intervene is a case in which where we're worried that in the event that he gets upset, his illness will get worse and he could be in danger going forward. Whereas if someone who's healthy, it's not the same concern. But the point is that he has a concern where somebody has been ill before. I didn't bring enough of the tshuva. I really should have brought more of the tshuva. But it's the same idea that if the illness could resurface and be a problem, then we're worried about the effects down the line. It's not only about the immediate effects right now. There's much more to be said, but hopefully this provided something of an introduction. Thank you very much. Hang on one second. Let's see if